Welcome to Vital Interest. My name is Karen Greenberg, and I am the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Our podcast is designed to help you understand security in its many dimensions. Each week, we will bring you thoughtful voices from the worlds of policy, government, law, journalism, and advocacy. We will look at the challenges that confront us today and tomorrow, from pandemic to climate change, from terrorism to population migration, from war to peace, all with an eye towards the rule of law, the protection of human rights, and the respect for civil liberties. Vital Interest Podcast is committed to making the world we live in more comprehensible, the part we play in it more engaged, and our futures more secure. It is our way here at CNS of connecting with our times and with one another.
We are 20 years out from 9/11. And if we look at the Global Counterterrorism Index that was published last week, anybody want to tell me that these policies that have marginalized, excluded, enabled authoritarianism in bloated security sectors around the globe, that these are actually solving the problems in Mali, Nigeria? We could name a host of countries. So the problem is that actually there's an unwillingness to see that it's not working. And the costs of it not working are financial, they're social, they're political, and ultimately they make us vulnerable to more violence.
Welcome to today's episode of Vital Interest Podcast. That was Professor Fionnuala Niolohin, currently the United Nations Special Rapporteur for Counterterrorism and Human Rights. She is also a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, faculty director of the Human Rights Center there, and she is also a professor at Queen's University of Belfast School of Law. Fionnuala Niolohin is a prolific author, and among other places, you can find her articles on the law blog Just Security. She joins me today to talk about the post-9/11 transformations in matters of security and beyond, about the imperative of incorporating the regard for human rights in the counterterrorism agenda, and about the children of tomorrow. So welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get started in talking about your work today, I wanted to ask you when you got started. When you got started in the business of focusing on human rights, its intersection with law, its intersection with security at many levels, where did you start out in this conversation?
So it started in Belfast. I went to law school in Belfast in the mid-1980s. And it was at the height of the conflict. So it was everywhere. I went to a law school where actually my classes were de facto divided into three sections. There were the Catholics who sat at one part of the classroom, the Protestants who sat in another, and those who didn't want to affiliate who sat in the middle between the two. And so pretty soon after I went to law school, I joined a small human rights organization called the Committee on the Administration of Justice. And I was a volunteer. I made 1,000 cups of tea as a law student, but I dug into the kind of daily piece of human rights in a conflict and the abuses of human rights, which included the extrajudicial use of force, the use of torture. Many of the listeners might know the Ireland-UK case, that famous case about hooding and torturing people who were suspected of being members of the IRA but weren't, were often just people engaged in civil rights activism. And so it shaped me as a lawyer. In Ireland, you go to law school when you're 18. So I went to law school when I was 18 in Belfast, and that was what shaped me. And it's from there that I guess I got embedded, and I just saw this as my life's work. It really hasn't changed that much since the mid-1980s in Belfast.
So I want to skip ahead to today and ask you a very basic question, which is, what does the Special Rapporteur for Counterterrorism and Human Rights do?
So I'm appointed by the Human Rights Council, which is a body, unfortunately, that the US does not currently participate in. They withdrew in 2016 as President Trump became president and decided that was not a fora. But it's a fora whose role, at least, is to engage states in their human rights obligations. So I have, in the first instance, you get a 3-year term. You're appointed from a country. So I'm an Irish special rapporteur. But once you're appointed, you're an independent expert. And you have 3 capacities. So the first is that I have an office, a very small staff in Geneva. We receive complaints or communications from individuals who've been affected by a counterterrorism practice somewhere in the world. And we have hundreds of those cases. And we have very little capacity to deal with all of them, but we select the individual cases. So a good example of that, Karen, is like we have intervened in a number of cases involving returnees, so children who find themselves in Al-Hol or Raj camp in Syria, and we engage with their governments about bringing them home. The second thing we do is I do country visits. So at the invitation of a government, I can visit a country and undertake a complete assessment of the compliance of their national law in the area of counterterrorism with human rights. And we've done a bunch of those: Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, Sri Lanka, Kazakhstan, Belgium, and France since I've become SR. And then the third thing I do is I issue annual reports to the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly, where I pick an issue that I think is really important in the counterterrorism space, where I think states have better or more or different work to do. And I give them advice that they may not want on how to do better.
In your recent report, the one that came out earlier this fall, the annual report for 2020, you said you were concerned about the apparent displacement of human rights and humanitarian law norms as a result of the wholesale application of counterterrorism law in practice. Now, I'm assuming that wasn't new to this year, but you did seem to think that it needed emphasis in this particular year. And so I'm curious, you know, we've had a long time as an international community to talk about the intersection between security issues and, for lack of a better word, rule of law, you know, liberty issues. So why now? What's changed now?
So I think that it states the obvious. We're coming up to the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And 9/11 is this extraordinary, as I don't need to tell New Yorkers and you in particular, Karen, what an extraordinary event that was. But it is important to know that the changes and the architecture and the structures that were built out in the counterterrorism space immediately after 9/11 have not stopped growing. In fact, if anything, they've consolidated, extended, entrenched, and got deeper and more profound in many parts of the world. And so the result of that is, for example, we have a massive architecture within the UN system that now does counterterrorism. That was not the case 20 years ago. We have these new organizations that I bet maybe many of your listeners haven't heard about: the Global Counterterrorism Forum, the Financial Action Task Force, the Shanghai Framework Agreement. These are all CT or bodies that are doing counterterrorism work regionally, globally, and nationally. And one of the consequences of that consolidation and growth has been that CT law, I think of it as a Pac-Man, you know, those little Pac-Man machines where everything eats everything up. CT is eating everything around it up. And so a really good example of that is some of your listeners may have been following the case of the women drivers in Saudi Arabia. One of them, a really prominent human rights actor, was transferred into a terrorism court last week for advocating on behalf of women's rights in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And there are hundreds of cases like that.
When you say hundreds of cases like that, what you mean is people who are doing things in the name of rights, liberties, and protections, who are then seen in that capacity within the context of laws that apply to terrorists.
Right. So bear in mind, we don't have a global definition of terrorism. And one of the biggest fault lines that comes out of 9/11 is that every state gets to define who their terrorists are without reference to any standards, which means that there's a perfect gentleman's agreement among states that no one ever calls anyone else out on their definition of who is a terrorist. So in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, that may be women drivers. In China, we've seen Uyghurs, we have seen protesters. The latest law in China for Hong Kong is a law that defines all kinds of protected acts under international law, speech, assembly, the right to politically participate, as terrorism under domestic law. So that's exactly what I mean, is that it's literally eating everything up, including traditional bodies of law like the law of armed conflict. So increasingly, what I see is in many countries where we certainly have violence, and this isn't an advocacy for violence, but it's saying we have other systems and rules that can deal with those violences, which includes the law of armed conflict. And what we're seeing is a displacement of that law, because it's much more convenient for states to say someone is a terrorist than to say that they're a combatant. Because in the former, the rules that apply are much fewer and the constraints that apply are virtually none at all.
I like your phrase, you know, this gentleman's agreement, you know, across countries, across regions. Where's the oversight? Where's the pushback? Is it basically out of the UN and independent NGO human rights organizations that come up? Is there any country that we can look at and say, this country has tried to moderate its security versus liberty issues better than others?
So it's a really good question, because one of the biggest challenges here is oversight, Karen. So if we look at the UN structure that was built after 9/11, we have a counterterrorism committee that was put in place underneath the Security Council. We have a CTED, a counterterrorism executive directorate, that was put in place to service that body. On the other side of the house in the General Assembly, we now have something called the Office of Counterterrorism, run by an Undersecretary General, which started off with four people in full-time positions 3 years ago and now has 148 people at last count working for it. It's bigger than, for example, the Office of the High Commission for Human Rights in New York. But the human rights pieces, the oversight pieces of that are non-existent. The oversight, the only entity mandated within the UN system to oversee the intersection between counterterrorism and human rights is me. And I am an part-time, unpaid, full-time law professor doing a job that really ought to be done by an office, an independent office with resources and capacities. But this is precisely what states want, because if states wanted oversight of counterterrorism, they would create it and pay for it. And they don't. So this is precisely why we don't have oversight. At the national level, there's some countries that are doing a better job than others, mm-hmm. but we still see really big deficits nationally.
So to the question, is there a state to look towards? There really isn't a model yet.
I mean, I see some countries who have done a better job, and I think there are models in there. And I use the country in the context I grew up in, which is the United Kingdom always, even at the height of the conflict, had an independent reviewer of terrorism mm-hmm. and an office that supported that. High-profile, resource-supported, independent oversight of their counterterrorism structures and practices. And those experts often said things the government did not want to hear. And it was always my sense, and remains my sense today, that the willingness of a mature democracy to hear criticism and to readjust itself in response to that criticism is what produces better policy, including better CT policy. So I think of the UK as a good example in this area. I think of Australia also has an independent oversight mechanism. But beyond those countries that have really committed to be self-aware and to hear what they don't want to hear, the best kind of advice is often the advice you don't want. What we're reliant on are increasingly fragmented and underfunded civil society and NGOs, who in many countries are the single largest target of counterterrorism and extremism measures. So inversely, the populations who are being subject to these provisions are the ones we should also be relying on to help push back against them.
Do you think the reason that there hasn't been more of a balanced conversation about it and the structural checks and balances on the power of counterterrorism authorities, do you think the reason is that terrorism seems to persist? It's a forever war, and there's an acceptance that it's always going to be a forever war?
I see a couple of things that have really shaped our universe of counterterrorism since 9/11. One is fear-based governance. And of course, like, I grew up in a conflict where I had to decide any given morning how I was driving to get to law school, because a bridge might be, you know, there's a bomb on a bridge. Many of us have lived in places where that calculus is sort of part of daily life. But I also think that we've seen this enormous shift in governance to fear-based politics that drives the unwillingness of states to look to take risk or to even experiment with other ways of managing the problem. I think the second reason that we see this, which is really complicated, is that you know, it's hard to champion the rights of those who do harm to you. I mean, the very essence of democracy is that we extend rights to those that do harm, that break the law, that are not with the program. But that's precisely what distinguishes open, transparent, free, and accountable societies from those who are not. So I think we've sort of lost the values part of this, that actually what defines us is that we don't simply run on militarized responses. I think the third thing is that I think there's been a failure, and this is the reckoning on 9/11, is that the problem is it doesn't work if you don't engage the rule of law and human rights. We are 20 years out from 9/11. And if we look at the Global Counterterrorism Index that was published last week, anybody want to tell me that these policies that have marginalized, excluded, enabled authoritarianism in bloated security sectors around the globe, that these are actually solving the problems in Mali, Nigeria? We could name a host of countries. So the problem is that actually there's an unwillingness to see that it's not working. And the costs of it not working are financial, they're social, they're political, and ultimately they make us vulnerable to more violence.
You know, I wanted to just talk about Guantanamo for a minute and the military commissions. It was a while ago that you co-authored that book with Oren Gross, Guantanamo and Beyond, Exceptional Courts and Military Commissions in Comparative Perspective. But I think it still pertains today. And one of the things the book addresses is due process exceptionalism, which is sort of a contradiction in terms. But I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Having written that book, I finally, 2 years later, got to visit Guantanamo. I hadn't been, and I got clearance to go, and I got to see what it's always interesting as an author, as you know, to write about something. Yeah. And then I sat in on 9/11 trials. So I think one of the problems, again, here is that we expect courts to do the work of managing the political outfalling of failed security policies. And the limits of that have been robustly revealed at Guantanamo. Yeah. The second thing is, I think those of us who listen closely to what's happening in jihadi circles, in violent extremism places, Guantanamo continues to be a resonant source of an inspiration to a marker of the failure of democracy, the failure of the rule of law. It remains an agitational kind of touch point for so many who want to use the existence of that place as a reason to encourage violence. And our failure to address it simply allows that to fester. And the third, as you know better than I can, is just it's been conveniently forgotten about, with the exception of Carl Rosenberg's extraordinary journalistic endeavors to continue to remind us of the prescient day-to-dayness of life. And it seems to me that the festering, the allowance of Guantanamo has also enabled, if we want to call it, mini Guantanamos, the most obvious of which I think is the situation in the camps in Syria and Iraq, where our tolerance to accept Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has created the fertile ground in which we think it's appropriate for hundreds of children to be held in subhuman conditions without any legal process. So Guantanamo breeds other things.
That's fascinating. So you would, in terms of just your larger perspective of the things we started after 9/11 have blossomed into things that are even more dire and more rights depriving. And so you would see a link between the indefinite detention at Guantanamo and these camps in which the children are being held. But that's actually a vast difference. The women and children in these camps, that would be a very different thing than taking people who are considered to be somewhat tied to Al-Qaeda and terrorism. So let's talk a little bit about why these children are held, mm-hmm. how they're treated. And I mean how they're treated, not just in terms of food and shelter, but how they're treated in terms of suspicion mm-hmm. and where we see this going. So I know it's not a pretty picture, but would you like to draw it for us?
In the camps, what we see with the children, the word I want to use is unchilding as a philosophical concept. It's a word used by a Palestinian feminist scholar, Nadira Shaloub Kevorkian, who talks about the ways in which children are unchilded, where we turn them into non-children, We ignore their age. We treat them as objects of suspicion. We call them terrorists by virtue of who they were born to or the place in which they were born. We do not afford them the rights that we think all children are allowed to have. And we treat their very existence as suspicious and threatening without ever doing an evaluation of the individual child or thinking about what the possibilities for any child might be. And so that philosophical concept, Karen, is what drives the way I see us treating these children in these camps. We see, for example, young boys being separated from their mothers as soon as they're 12 or 13 on the assumption that as soon as they turn a particular age, they are adult men and to be treated as terrorists and put into prison conditions where none of their rights are observed. And it's extraordinary that we have Western states who claim to be the bastions of democracy and the rule of law and the defenders of the rights of the child, who are prepared to let their children languish in conditions that I and my team and other special rapporteurs have found to be torture, inhuman, and degrading treatment under international law. And that tolerance is morally and politically unacceptable and corrupt. It does not make us safer. And I would say we've had very clear and robust statements from security actors in multiple countries who are telling us that if we want to be secure in the long term, we need to bring these children home.
Just a curiosity, are there any new organizations that have sprung up to deal with these women and children, or is it pretty much on the backs of already existing organizations?
You know, as far as the mandate can tell, it's mostly existing organizations who are advocating. And I think what's really interesting, Karen, is so many of these organizations, you know, these women and children, the response in many countries to them, the public response is also quite grim, right? They left. They chose not to stay in our country. But bear in mind, and I have interviewed some of these women, many of these young women and many of them who are in the camps went as children themselves. Some of them, not all of them, were groomed online. Some of them were taken by older family members. And as soon as they turned 18 and some younger than that, I mean, we think of Shamima Begum, this young British girl, as an example, who had two children before she turned 18. Technically, under British law, she was statutorily raped at least twice before she turned 18 and had her citizenship stripped for her.
Still being litigated though, right?
The mandate is part of that litigation, actually. We are involved in that litigation. And so, I think what we're seeing is the drip drip of these cases through the European courts. And that in many ways, those countries are quite prepared to let the drip drip happen because sometimes these cases take years to resolve. And a humanitarian solution isn't being found or sought. Now, there are some exceptions. The US has been really good on this issue. The US has been clear, including both the Trump administration, and they expect the incoming Biden administration to say you have to bring your nationals home. And the key point, I would say, Karen, is those women who have committed serious crimes, prosecute them, because that's what the victims of terrorism deserve. They deserve trials that are fair and open and transparent. And the victims of terrorism deserve to have the states who can prosecute these individuals prosecute them. So no one is getting a fair deal here. The women and the children aren't getting a fair deal. But let's also be clear, the victims of terrorism in whose name these countries often speak when they undertake their CT measures are also not getting a fair deal.
And we do have the laws and we do have the institutions to do those prosecutions.
Right.
You've written a lot over the decades. One theme that's gone through your work is gender.
Yeah.
Certainly, you've tried to blast through some myths about, you know, female terrorists or female ISIS fighters and what actually attracts them and what they think they're committing themselves to. I'm really curious about your larger interest in gender and how you see it in this conversation.
As you know, Karen, I think we share this in common, is that being a woman in the national security space is somewhat of an anomaly. So I think that instinctively that brings you sometimes to see things or to be aware of things. I think in the context for me, historically, it goes back to Belfast. You know, I often feel like I'm reliving my life through the circa Belfast 1985 through 1990s. But understanding the complexity of violence, you know, violence is a complex phenomenon. Both men and women engage and are caught up in violence in ways that are not monochrome. And, you know, some of my early work focused on the mobilization. What are the factors? You know, people often tend to see women as victims of terrorism. And it is true that there's an appropriate and important way to understand the complexity of what it means to be a female victim of terrorism, whether it's in the context of Boko Haram or Yazidi, where we often associate that with sexual violence. But not only, there are a myriad of ways when women are caretakers and they are the victims of terrorism, the complexity of terrorism for the range of roles that women play in society is, I think, poorly understood and undermapped. Equally, the kinds of motivations that women have to engage in violence are poorly understood. There are often quite logical reasons why women want to engage in violence. Violence is a way to power. In many societies, holding a gun is a way to be safe. We may not like why you're holding a gun, but understanding the rationality of the choice in contexts of scarce resources or insecurity helps us understand better how we prevent violence. So I think seeing that range of reasons why women become engaged in violence, and that we can also understand responsibility, as well as at the other end, you know, demobilization, reintegration, because let's be clear, in places like Bosnia and Rwanda, where we had massive genocides, but enormous commitment from the international community, we essentially got a couple of hundred cases of trials. And if we think of what happened in Syria and Iraq, we are going to struggle to prosecute a fraction of the harms that covered. So we have to understand how we demobilize and reintegrate people, and that includes women. But I guess the other things I think about, like I think about things like countering terrorism financing through a gender lens.
How so?
When we list somebody, when we put someone on a sanctions list, for example, we often forget that they have dependents. Those dependents, they're usually male. So we know that these structures are male in terms of who tends to get listed. And those family structures are often family structures in which the male head of household is the only one who has access to funds or who has the right to alienate property or is the primary provider of all the goods. So when you freeze everything, you're not just freezing it for the man who's in your sight. You're freezing it for the woman and the family who are dependent on him. And so that's a gendered effect. We don't talk about it in those terms. And mostly, and this is some of the work the mandate's been doing, is we don't create the kinds of exemptions that make sure that we don't collectively punish families for the actions of a head of household, whether that's male or female, around financing of terrorism.
You've been thinking a little bit lately about COVID.
Yes.
And how COVID intersects with the other issues you work on, like this increasing securitization of police, of counterterrorism officials. How do you negotiate that conversation? We all want to make sure we live in a COVID-free or COVID-controlled world. So on the one hand, we have what you refer to as an increasingly autocratic mechanisms to keep us safe from this pandemic. On the other hand, we have these increasingly invasive autocratic methods to keep us safe from terrorism that need reform. How do we understand the overlap of these two things? Do we just wait it out and not deal with the complexities? What should we do?
Well, yeah, and I think this is a thing. This is something the mandate's been thinking a lot about, for two reasons. One is because as the COVID, the pandemic, the scale, the effect, and the consequences of the pandemic became clear in early March, we saw a massive resort to exceptional powers across the world, emergency powers. And in many countries, there's a really clear overlap between emergency powers and security powers. Those two things are in the same box legally in many countries. The other thing that I was seeing was actually the repurposing of counterterrorism law to cover the pandemic.
So where, for example, did you see
this? Countries like that we saw where, in fact, they did not need to put in place new legislation for COVID. A good example is Sri Lanka,
yeah,
where the existence of the PTA and the powers that had been in place, they were able to repurpose or use existing CT powers to manage lockdowns, to manage curfews, because they were in use already. So these two things, I think, were really striking to me. The second thing I think I would say, Karen, is that we know that emergency or exceptional powers once taken are really hard to undo. The problem with emergencies is that once you go there, the legal system and the institutional actors who benefit from an array of new powers actually don't want to give them up because they have all kinds of, you know, advantages. They're easier, they sidecut human rights or rule of law constraints, they limit certain kinds of oversight that can be cumbersome. So I think these things were really apparent to me. The other thing that was really apparent to me was that the tools that, again, have been at the cutting edge of CT development for security purposes are also really attractive in a health emergency: surveillance, data collection, biometric data use, artificial intelligence sources. Datafication is the central tool being used by counterterrorism practice in the 21st century. And we saw the UN counterterrorism architecture gearing up and saying to governments, hey, we have a bunch of tools that you can use to manage your COVID crisis. And my team were saying, no, we need to really think about whether those are the tools that we should be using. And I say that for two reasons. One is just the danger that you're using tools that are not fit for purpose. These tools were not designed for health emergencies. They were designed for something else. And the assumption that one is just the same as the other is both intellectually and policy flawed. The second, I think, really important thing here is that the communities that have suffered the most from COVID, communities of color and minority communities in this country and in other countries, are also the communities that have historically had the hardest and most challenging relationships with the security sector. So it seems absolutely, I think, antithetical to think that those communities who already have pre-existing, complex, challenging, non-transparent relationships with these security sector actors would be subject to the double bind of then being further policed by, securitized by, surveyed by those same communities. And so that's where I think the mandate's voice has been trying to kind of say that it's very hard because people are afraid. And when people are afraid, as we, you and I both know really well, Karen, from 9/11, they're prepared to give away a lot.
Yeah, this is really something I think we need to think about as creatively and constructively as possible going forward. Before we get to our last question, let me ask you, do you think that President Biden will rejoin the Human Rights Council at the UN?
I think there's a great hope that a President Biden would do that. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One is the Human Rights Council is not a perfect body. It's a highly problematic body with many serious human rights abusers sitting on it and not being fully held accountable. But it's the only body we have. And when the US chooses to sit outside of these bodies, the law and the practice and the transparency and the openness that the US is in a position to be a moral and legal advocate for gets lost. As many of us have said in the UN system, the US has been at the margins of both human rights and security conversations in the UN system for 4 years. And it has, in many cases, abandoned the multilateralism that has been at the heart of the compact among states since 1945. That does not make us more secure or more prepared for the challenges we have. And I think it is really important for the US to show up now, because nature abhors a vacuum. And that vacuum has been filled in the last 4 years. And we need to show up and edge our way back into the conversation.
Yes. Our last question is always the same. What gives you hope?
I mean, I think those of us who do human rights and have done it our whole lives, we're on a long journey. We don't have expectations for quick wins. We don't expect that we will win in the short run. And so what gives me hope is the long arc of history, which bends towards justice, to quote that very famous quote by Dr.
Martin Luther King.
And I think what it does is that it tells us that even when we think we're losing, we're winning. Because in the long run, the moral claims we make, the values we hold, are the things that make lives better, not just for us, but around the globe. And that was true for me in Belfast when I was 18 years old. And I saw the course of that conflict resolve, not perfectly, but better. And it still remains my view today that the long arc that we are in is one that will bend towards human rights and the rule of law. And that's what gives me hope.
Well, I thank you for that. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope you come back and report back on what's happened after next year.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. We hope it made your day a little brighter, a little clearer, and a little more informed. Join us next time for the newest installment of Vital Interest Podcast. In the meantime, feel free to send us your questions at vitalinterestpodcast.org and to follow us on Twitter at @VI_podcastCNS. And make sure to check out our daily morning brief, our weekly cyber brief, and our Vital Interest online forum at CenterOnNationalSecurity.org. Have a wonderful week, and please stay safe.